Our next speaker is Liz Everton. Liz is a fairly recent PhD from UCLA. Her dissertation title was Sisters and Soldiers, the Representation and Participation of Women in the Anti-Dreyfusard Movement. She has a manuscript in preparation drawing on her dissertation, and that is tentatively titled National Heroines, Women and the Radical Right During the Dreyfus Affair. She has several articles, and I wish to mention here today only one, and that's titled Senses of Perceptions and Revelation, Gender and Truth in the Anti-Dreyfusard Caricature, which appeared in French Historical Studies quite recently, and which was the runner-up for the French Studies Malcolm Bowie Article Prize in 2013. Liz is currently adjunct faculty at Concordia University, and I must say on a personal note, she's very active and a most valued member of the executive board of the Coordinating Council of Women in History. Liz's paper today is entitled A Republic of Letters for the Anti-Enlightenment, the Henri Subscription, December 1898 to January 1899. Thank you, Liz.
Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, everyone, for being here. So from Emma Wust's Positive and Inclusive Action Française in the Plural, let's now turn to the more familiar and unfortunate connotations of the phrase, shifting from the Dreyfusards to the anti-Dreyfusards, and in particular to the high water mark or low point of the anti-Dreyfusard movement, which is the Henri Subscription. So the Henri Subscription, often erroneously called the Henri Monument, was a mammoth subscription drive carried out by the anti-Semitic daily newspaper La Libre Parole. It was kicked off on December 13, 1898, by an article by nationalist and militarist writer Marianne de Beauvais, in which she solicited donations for a defamation suit brought by Berthe Henry, the widow of the military conspirator Joseph Henry, against Dreyfusard Joseph Renac, a Jewish journalist and politician. Starting the next day, La Libre Parole published lists of subscriber names and messages, along with a running tally of the sum raised. By the time the drive was closed on January 15, 1899, almost 20,000 names and messages had been published, and 130,000 francs had been raised, mostly from small contributions. Both Dreyfusards and anti-Dreyfusards alike immediately identified the Henri Subscription as a watershed moment in the Dreyfus Affair. From the start, there was a sense of that the seemingly interminable lists meant something. But meaning, of course, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. Most Dreyfusards followed the lead of Pierre Quillard, who, underwritten by the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme, published a compilation of subscription entries organized by profession, social status, and attitudes expressed in subscriber messages. For Quillard, the Henri Subscription represented an outpouring of anti-Semitism, inflected with militarism and clericalism, and his goals in compiling and publishing the entries were to name and shame contributors and to reveal the latent hatred at the subscription's core. Historical analyses of the Henri Subscription have followed suit, asking, kind of roughly, who the subscribers were and just how anti-Semitic they really were. These questions are the product of a shared methodological starting point among historians, and that is the use of the Quillard compilation rather than the original lists. This practice is problematic for several reasons. First, the Quillard compilation is a copy of a copy. And you know, for that matter, it's not only a copy of a copy, it's a copy of an imperfect copy. The original subscriber letters and notes and even the records of La Libre Parole have been lost in the archive or to the archives. And it is evident from looking at the lists themselves that the lists that were published in the newspapers were actually actively edited by the newspaper. So entries were omitted, they were altered, and they were arranged. But second, and perhaps more significantly, the Quillard compilation removes the original context from the lists and imposes a new ordering system, one that's defined by a Dreyfusard interpretive framework that's exterior to the subscription itself. Dreyfusard beliefs and needs in 1899 shaped Quillard's organization of the entries, from his privileging of donations by the military, clergy, and aristocracy to his grouping of subscriber messages. So, for example, he groups into different chapters insults against intellectuals and incitement of hatred against Jews, Protestants, freethinkers, and Republicans. This is a distinction that the anti-Dreyfusards themselves would not have made. So what meaning did the anti-Dreyfusards ascribe to the Henri subscription? La Libre Parole, at the height of the subscription, celebrated the patriotic hodgepodge of subscribers, in which the wealthy and powerful rubbed shoulders with the young girls of the École Nationale des Arts Décoratifs. This was the true France, as opposed to the false Third Republic. So this paper today represents early results from a project intended to uncover what the Henri subscription meant to ordinary anti-Dreyfusards, so not just to La Libre Parole, but to the people who were actually sending in money to these lists. Since the spring, I've been working with a research assistant, Margaret Zerbel, to input the 20,000 subscriptions published in La Libre Parole into a database. So with this data set, we will not only be able to track patterns across the entire subscription, but to identify change over time by looking at individual daily lists. We hope to make the database available on an online open access platform so that future researchers might be able to access and analyze it. This project is very much a work in progress, so today I'm going to be confining my remarks to information gleaned from the first three lists, so December 14th, 15th, and 16th. The key historiographical debate about the Henri subscription centers on its ideological nature, whether it should be interpreted above all as a manifestation of popular anti-Semitism, or whether it represents a broader anti-Dreyfusism, encompassing anti-Semitism, nationalism, clericalism, militarism, conservatism, royalism, and so on. Looking at the lists themselves, however, tends to reorient one's approach. The finished product of the Henri subscription fades to be superseded by an image of a work in progress, a collective project undertaken through the collaboration of thousands of subscribers and guided by the active intervention of the editors of La Libre Parole. The Henri subscription lists acted as a site of sociability and a locus of identity. Through their participation, subscribers communicated with the newspaper, with other subscribers, and with non-subscribing readers. They also publicly identified themselves with the anti-Dreyfusard movement and the imagined community that it represented. So perhaps the most striking aspect of the Henri subscription to be recovered through a return to the original lists is its complexity as a site of communication. Unlike the Quillard Compendium, the Henri subscription lists existed not only to put anti-Dreyfusard attitudes on display retrospectively, but to inspire further submissions in the moment. Subscribers were encouraged to read and imitate, and in so doing, to motivate further imitation. This encouragement came not only from La Libre Parole and other media outlets, but from the subscribers themselves. For example, entry 924 in the December 16th list stated that to give for the defense of Colonel Henri's memory is the duty of all true French people. From encouragement, of course, it's only a very short step to public shaming. An example of this may be seen in entry 63 in the December 15th list, the wife of a poor officer who is shocked not to see the name of the Minister of War at the head of the first list. These sorts of appeals did not go unheard or unremarked, and the name of General Mercier, who was the Minister of War who engineered Dreyfus's arrest and conviction, indeed appeared at the head of the next day's list. So, shaming is effective. What we see with the Henri subscription, then, is a complex form of multi-directional communicative exchange. It functioned as a public site where subscribers could communicate with the newspaper, with each other, with non-subscribing readers, and with those involved in the anti-Dreyfusard movement more broadly. These communications ranged from the generic to the surprisingly personal. Subscribers shared potentially humiliating information about themselves, their personal courage, their personal financial resources. And they offered support that ranged from respectful tributes to Lieutenant Colonel Henri to hugs and kisses for his child. While the lists themselves were public, subscribers could also choose how much information they wished to reveal. Some, like Madame Launay, who was a staunch financial supporter of the Ligue Antisémitique, provided their street address, along with their name or initials. Others provided identifying information such as nationality, region or city of origin or residence, occupation, or organizational or family connections. This information could be paired with names or initials or presented on its own or part of a longer message. So for example, we have an Algerian woman who admires Drumont. The variety of forms of self-identification suggests that subscribers were acutely aware that they were participating in a public form of communication. They were not simply speaking for the pleasure of speaking itself, but in the consciousness that they were being heard. And this consciousness is particularly visible in a small subset of messages submitted by subscribers acquainted with or purporting to be acquainted with the Henri family or others associated with the case. Messages such as, for the unhappy widow, an old general in memory of Mademoiselle Marie-Anne de Beauvais' father, his former boss, Colonel M, for the widow of his former brother-in-arms in the second Zouave, or an old friend of Colonel Henri, suggest a belief on the part of the writer that Beauvais or Madame Henri was actually reading the published lists and would welcome support not only from strangers but from old friends. Subscribers employed the lists not only as a means of communication but also of self-expression, ranging from the serious to the lighthearted. An example of the latter can be found in the wordplay of entry 186 on the December 15th list, three Protestants protesting against Protestants. So that's trois Protestants protestant contre les Protestants. Take what you can get with humor in this. Other subscribers took advantage of the list format to set up fairly elaborate multi-line entries mimicking poetry and dialogue. One example of this comes in the December 15th list, with three subscriptions of 2 francs apiece, consisting of three messages designed to be read together. In form, they represent cartoon captions or lines from a play. You have the speaker and then the line, followed by the line. So read in what is the intended order, a brief exchange emerges in which the Frenchman laments that he used to have 60 billion francs and now only has half. The Jew gloats that he stole 30 million or 30 billion francs, and the gendarme warns the thief to watch out. There is also evidence to suggest that the editors in charge of compiling the lists did not simply publish entries randomly. Important entries were often, but not always, placed near the start of the day's list, though not necessarily at the head. For example, subscriptions from the staff members of the newspaper L'Intransigeant occupied entries 11 to 29 in the December 15th list. This meant that all 19 of these entries appeared on the front page, which was an act of courtesy that both served to advertise the relationship of La Libre Parole with the similarly anti-Dreyfusard L'Intransigeant, and also to establish L'Intransigeant's anti-Dreyfusard bona fides. Taken together, these examples of multi-directional and intentional communication by subscribers and editors suggest that meaning can and should be found not only in the content of the lists, but in their construction. While I was working on this project, I returned time and again to the idea of the Republic of Letters, as expounded upon by Dina Goodman. This is a system of reciprocal exchanges working towards a common enlightenment project, out of which emerges an oppositional public sphere. In her words, a polity parallel to the monarchy, but entwined with it, the double helix of early modern France. Drawing a connection between the Henri subscription and the Enlightenment Republic of Letters seems absurd, given the disdain and distrust many anti-Dreyfusards felt for the legacy and values of the Enlightenment. But similarities exist nonetheless in the subscription's collective and collaborative nature, its impulse to critique and transform the existing state, and its creation of an oppositional counterstate and locus of identity. So, if the Henri subscription is an intentional, productive, and transformative project, represents a sort of counterstate within the Third Republic, who are its citizens? For the remainder of my talk, I'll provide a breakdown of the demographics of the first list with some introductory caveats. As has been established, the temporal aspects of these lists is crucial. The list changed over time as subscribers and would-be subscribers responded to events, to articles, and to the lists themselves. The makeup of the first list should therefore not be seen necessarily as representative of subsequent lists or of the subscription as a whole. So to springboard off the idea that the lists influence the lists, it should also be noted that this first list is by far the shortest. The subscription was opened on December 13th, and the first list of 126 entries published on December 14th. As the subscription proceeded, the list became much longer. So the second list, on December 15th, included 487 subscriptions, the third, 957, and the fourth, 1,399. The longer the subscription went on and the longer the lists became, the harder, of course, they were to ignore, so that those who might not have subscribed early on could be swept up in the momentum of the Army subscription by the end of the month. The names that appear on the first list, then, are those of people responding solely to Beauvais's article and to the pre-existing coverage of Madame Henri's case. They're most likely regular readers of La Libre Parole because the appeal for subscriptions was reprinted in friendly newspapers on December 14th, so the same day as the first list was published. And they were also predominantly from Paris and its suburbs, though the subscription itself eventually became a national and even an international affair. If you think about the practical limits of the postal service, even the most fervent of provincial or colonial anti-Semites could not possibly have gotten their subscription in by December 14th. It wasn't that good. With this said, it's possible to cautiously extract meaning from these first subscriptions. As I said, the first list contains 126 subscriptions. Unfortunately, one of these is illegible due to a flaw in the microphone. Okay. Of these, the majority, 104, were submitted by individuals. Two of these, entries 23 and 24, were from individuals sharing a surname. Their consecutive placement, along with their shared name, suggests that these two individuals, one man and one woman, were family members. They were probably brother and sister. Additionally, 8 subscriptions were sent in by non-family groups, 3 by family groups, and 3 by organizations. So La Libre Parole, the newspaper L'Anti-Juif, and the organization the Livre Anti-Juif. Of the remaining 7 subscriptions, it's impossible to say whether they were submitted by individuals or groups, as they consist either of the placeholder anonymous or of messages without any personal identifying information. So of the 104 known individual subscribers, 63 of them, a little over 60%, can be identified as male, either by first names, contextual clues such as professions, or grammatical indicators such as the gender of adjectives and articles. 13 subscribers, or 16%, were identifiably female, based again on first names or the presence of the title Mademoiselle or Madame. The gender of the 24 remaining subscribers is unclear. These subscriptions were either identified by initials only, first initial and surname, or surname only. Most historians have tended to assume that these were men, but you actually do see examples where contextual clues show that these initials only or surname only were female. So for example, in entry 309 in the December 15th list, F.A., a broken-hearted French woman who would still like to believe in justice. So breaking the list down in this way argues for a revision of assumptions about its demographics. In his geographical and socioeconomic analysis of the list, Stephen Wilson estimates that 10% of the subscribers were female. But based on this first list, this number is almost certainly far too low. Given the tendency of female subscribers to seek various forms of anonymity, it seems likely that an even larger percentage than 16% of these completely anonymous subscriptions were indeed from women. Women were also part of the relatively large number of family subscriptions, which are underrepresented in the first list. Also absent from the first list is another important subset of subscribers, and that's children. So we're back to Emma Wust and Pour nos enfants. Children constituted 2% of the 487 subscriptions in the second list. And children, this included 1 group subscription, so from 2 French babies to their little friend to defend his father's honor. And the other 10 were individual subscriptions, half with names and often ages provided, and half completely anonymous. So the anti-Dreyfusard Republic of Letters thus bore at least one striking difference from the Third Republic, and that is the inclusion of women and minors as full members. The subscriptions of women and children were listed alongside those of adult men with no distinction drawn between them. And indeed, in some cases, the socially conservative hierarchy of the family was actually turned topsy-turvy. Within sequences of individual subscriptions in the same family. So take, for example, the three subscriptions submitted by the Mui family, which were printed 1, 2, 3 right after each other. The first one to be printed was Madame Philippe de Mui, was the mother, followed by her husband and then their son. In other instances, minor children were actually placed ahead of adult family members in these sorts of kind of micro lists within the lists. Another difference between the state and counter-state is that this anti-Dreyfusard vision of the nation was rooted in ethno-nationalist concepts of identity that excluded religious minorities and those identified as foreign, in sharp contrast to the assimilationist Republican nation. But this exclusion was complicated, as we can see in a study of subscriber messages. Of the 122 non-organizational subscriptions, 51 contain no other identifier other than name or initial or the placeholder anonymous. Another 40 contain what can be termed neutral identifiers, such as address, city or region of origin, or profession. But the remaining 31, which is about 25% of that number, contain either messages or what I call charged identifiers, ways of identifying oneself that make what would have been during the Dreyfus affair a political statement. These charged identifiers could include simple self-identifications, an anti-Semite, a patriot, a Frenchman, or, as well as more complex statements of identity relating to personal history and behavior. Subscribers recounted their military history as combatants or prisoners in the Franco-Prussian War, and their victimization by enemies of France. They also staked their claim in the nation through statements of admiration or denigration. To admire Madame Henri or Drummond or the army, to denigrate Renac or the anti-Dreyfusards, these actions placed one within La Libre Parole's patriotic hodgepodge. Membership in the True Nation, writ small in the lists of the Henri subscription, was therefore not only a function of ethnicity, but also of action. Nowhere is this more clear than in subscriptions offered by self-identified members of groups ordinarily excluded from the True Nation a priori. Protestants, for example, were considered not French by many anti-Dreyfusards. Yet in the lists, we see not only the three protesting Protestants from earlier, but also a man who claimed to be Protestant but French in heart and soul, and the doubly foreign American Protestant woman, French at heart, who is disgusted by Protestants. But perhaps the most shocking subscriptions are those from Jews. Even if one rejects an interpretation of the Henri subscription as wholly anti-Semitic, the fact remains that it was an anti-Semitic activity published in an entirely anti-Semitic newspaper. Nevertheless, we see Jewish subscribers. It is, if not exactly easy, not entirely difficult to explain the presence in the lists of two famous converts from Judaism turned arch anti-Dreyfusards, and those are the newspaper editors Arthur Meillet and Gaston Polonais. But what are we to make of Lévy, ashamed of the conduct of his fellow Jews? Perhaps right conduct played in the anti-Dreyfusard nation a comparatively larger role than has previously been thought, so that even Jews such as Meillet and Polonais and Lévy might present themselves for inclusion. Further exploration of the Henri subscription, we hope, will shed lights on these cracks in the seemingly solid veneer of the anti-Dreyfusard nation. Thank you.